Next case is 10SC159, Judith Koenig versus Perco Fleet Services, Inc. Are both parties ready? Just as a housekeeping matter, argument set for an hour, half hour aside, and the petitioner will have to keep track of his to her time. Please state your name at the beginning of your argument.
Thank you, Justice Bender. Thank you, members of the court. And may it please the court. My name is Brendan Powers. I represent the petitioner, Judith Koenig. This case concerns damages arising out of a car rental contract. Ms. Koenig rented a vehicle from BDD Enterprises in Durango, Colorado. BDD Enterprises is a franchisee of National Car Rental. The court agreed there were five issues that the parties asked the court to take up on appeal, and the court selected two of those issues.
So basically, both parties are unhappy, right?
I think that's a good summary. There is a component of the Court of Appeals decision that both parties asked this court to consider, and I'm going to address that first issue on which both parties agree there was an error first. That question is whether the Court of Appeals erred in interpreting a car rental agreement permitting loss of use damages, quote, regardless of fleet utilization, close quote, as providing for such damages by proof of certain loss prerequisites. It is our position, we are going to ask the court to answer yes to that question. We do believe the Court of Appeals erred. The respondent agrees that there was an error in that. Our position that there is an error there lies within the legal precedent and the facts of the case itself. We do not believe that the legal precedent or the facts in this case support a rewriting of the rental contract in the manner that the Court of Appeals did. The second issue on appeal is whether the Court of Appeals erred in concluding that the measure of damages for loss of use should be net lost profit in this particular case involving the rental of a commercial vehicle, or the commercial rental of a vehicle, excuse me. To that question, we were going to ask the court to respond with a no. We don't believe there was error in using net lost profit for measuring damages arising out of a commercial contract such as this. I'd also like to briefly note that one of the issues on appeal that the respondent asked the court to consider was whether the Court of Appeals erred as a matter of law in concluding that liability for loss of use of a leased chattel turns an actual economic loss to the owner. I'm sorry, there's a typo in that. Whether it requires an actual economic loss to the owner. This court decided not to take up that issue from the Court of Appeals, and I read from that the court wants to let that part of the decision stand. It's important because it plays into where we believe the error lies in the interpretation of the contract, and particularly that phrase, and it's an unusual phrase, regardless of fleet utilization. The Court of Appeals found that there's no precedent to support an award of damages in a breach of contract case to a corporation who suffered no harm. The court appropriately distinguished the particular intrinsic value theory that the respondent relies on so heavily, and found that it applied to personal autos and had no application to personal vehicles that are rented for profit. And I think that's a critical point that moves this case into the very basic tenets of contract damages law. The use of the vehicle in this case is the product that is being sold by National Car Rental. National Car Rental owns its vehicles, and it virtually sells use to the consuming public. And I would like to discuss with the court how we interpret that contract in terms of the commercial use of the vehicle. A couple tenets that I think come into play. One, when there's a breach of contract, it is the court's objective, it is the party's objective, to place each party in the position that party would occupy had no breach occurred. Second, it is well settled law that plaintiff is not entitled to a windfall. They cannot recover money damages simply because the law recognizes a category of damages does not mean that you automatically get to collect that amount of damages. You still must come forward with affirmative proof that a actual economic loss has occurred. Third basic tenet that I want to use as the backdrop for my argument is that the distinction between general and special damages. General damages are those damages that naturally flow out of the occurrence itself. They are inevitable damages. And we'll use the personal injury context. If an individual breaks one's arm, it's inevitable that individual is going to need treatment to have that arm cast and taken care of. In the vehicle context, it's inevitable that that car is going to have to be repaired. Those are general damages. They should be distinguished from special damages. And both the Court of Appeals and specifically the opinion in Hunter versus Quaintance, which is a 1917 case that it's funny because the respondent is critical of that case, and yet the respondent cites that case twice in the respondent's brief. That case found that loss of use damages are special damages. Special damages, of course, are those damages that flow out of the occurrence, but are not necessarily inevitable damages. In this case, it would be loss of use, loss of profit, those types of damages that are not necessarily inevitable. In the personal injury context, I think an example would be a lost income claim. Yes, you have the right to make a lost income claim, but the court still requires a plaintiff to come forward with affirmative proof of an actual loss sustained. Not the theoretical desire to work and the theoretical inability to work. It is more an actual economic loss arising out of that. The Court of Appeals recognizes these basic tenets and incorporates them into their appeal, and then sort of jumps the track a little bit when it gets to the language in the contract, the rental car contract, referring to loss prerequisites. By doing so, by interpreting the regardless of fleet utilization language as creating these lost prerequisites, I think the court undoes exactly what it recognized. It recognized those basic tenets, it reiterated those basic tenets, and then creates an entirely new standard of law to basically, in my opinion, presume a loss where no loss has occurred. The two prerequisites are that they simply need to show that they were open for business that day and that there was a customer at the service counter, regardless of any of the other universe of circumstances that come into play.
Is there any jurisdiction that accepts that proposition?
None that I found. And the Court of Appeals acknowledges in its opinion that it has not been able to find a court that distinguishes that. I know.
But why isn't that language sort of directly contradict those principles? I mean, what is wrong with the interpretation that the renter agrees to pay loss of use, regardless of fleet utilization, as recognizing that there is a loss of use, even if the fleet isn't entirely utilized?
Justice Martinez, I have 2 points.
How you figure it out, if that's true, is another matter, but tell me why.
Correct. I think because it is altering the common law, and let's keep that in mind. When a contract chooses to alter the common law, the contract must do so expressly and specifically. To say regardless of fleet utilization, and here I would urge the court to adopt the reasoning of the trial court. When the trial court read that language, the trial court recognized it and said, yes, fleet utilization is one of the many theories that exist within the quiver of damages theory, if you will, by which one could prove loss of income or an actual loss, economic loss. Here, the drafter of the contract chose not to include that particular measure, if you will. There's a myriad of ways one can prove an actual economic loss. One can turn to the specific circumstances of the case. If there is a specific need for the vehicle at the time, evidence can be procured to demonstrate that specific need. Here, the Angela Horn, who is the owner of the National Outlet, testified in deposition that they had no need for this vehicle but to rent it. It was strictly a means of profit. Another way to measure or define an actual economic loss is to look at historic sales. You can look at seasonal sales. We can look at the tax returns. Tax returns always in a business always identify the cost of goods sold. And you can compare what are the cost of goods sold and the sales trends that exist within that particular business and define an actual economic loss.
Counsel, I guess I just don't understand your, tell me what that, regardless of fleet utilization language actually means. I mean, you're basically saying that they're just eliminating one measure of lost profits, but why would you put that in a contract then? That's the part I'm, that, what function does it serve then?
Well, I think the contract is, I guess my response first is I don't know. To me, when I sat down with the contract originally, when my clients sat down with the contract originally, it is a vague and ambiguous term. And we did not present that argument in the district court because when I read it, I viewed it as that's one measure that they don't want to get into. That for reasons unknown to us, National Car Rental does not want anybody scrutinizing how it uses its fleet or how its fleets exist. That's fine if they choose to do that, if they choose to remove that arrow from their quiver. But I'm uncomfortable then making the jump to, okay, well, we've now eliminated the entire requirement that they show or demonstrate an actual loss. I think that language, regardless of fleet utilization, does recognize that there may be situations, situational damages, in which the specific use of the vehicle is going to define the economic loss. Again, if it is a specialized car rental agency that specializes in limousines or specialized vehicles, there may be circumstances under which the utilization of the car rental agency doesn't want the utilization being scrutinized. But to take that verbiage and say, regardless of fleet utilization, suddenly wipes out an entire premise of damages law in the contractual setting is disconcerting.
But I maybe this is oversimplistic, but let me just throw it out there and we can bounce off of it. But it seemed to me like what it might be saying is, say National has 10,000 cars. You wouldn't have to show that 9,999 cars will be rented, and therefore you needed this one in order to make some additional profit.
And that is the way that the trial court interpreted that.
So you're taking that out. You're not looking at it in a macro sort of a way. You're saying irrespective of that, we're not going to figure it. You're going to owe us for a day of rent.
Which is what the respondent is attempting to do.
Right.
Is attempting to say.
And what's wrong with that? You know, you rented this car, you wrecked it. You have to keep paying us rent on it until it's fixed. I mean, I know that's so simplistic, but what's wrong with that approach?
It's not that it's wrong. It's that, and I understand that what the respondent wants to do is to say, therefore, we get to presume a loss. That's the conundrum. Is I don't believe it is appropriate to make the jump from we're not going to scrutinize the use of the vehicle. We're not going to look at the percentage of vehicles that are in our lot at this time. That's fine if they choose to remove that measure from this equation, but that doesn't eliminate all the other potential measures, and it certainly does not eliminate.
Sure, you're saying that they're assuming damage, but how else would they prove a need if they take out fleet utilization? I'm just kind of trying to think about what that proof would look like, and I guess that's how the Court of Appeals back into it. So maybe you'd presume a need by saying, oh, you're open. Somebody is there.
Two thoughts on that. One is that you can always prove lost income, again, in a myriad of different ways. They can establish a loss simply by saying, we have a unit cost per vehicle, this is our high season, and present it to the jury that way. Present it to the jury, present evidence to the jury that there is an actual economic impact on the company by virtue of its vehicle not being available to it. And I think the other thought I'd like to share is...
And the reality is there might well not be. I mean, every time I've ever been at a car rental place, there always seems to be lots of cars sitting around that are probably not being rented that particular day.
That is correct.
So it really is kind of a conundrum, isn't it? I mean, probably there wasn't an actual loss. They're not renting that day, but there might have been. So how do you actually prove it? How does one prove it if you take out fleet utilization?
My response to that question is I think there are ways to prove it by going through the books, by going through the sales records, by going through the tax returns.
Statistically, it's likely that it would have been rented had it been there?
Correct. And that the circumstances are such, the individual circumstances are such that the percentages dictate a loss in this particular case. But to say that we're going to take one set of circumstances, i.e., and we'll use a hotel as an example, there's 100 rooms in a hotel, and if a renter, guest were to destroy one, there's plenty of rooms left over. There's still damages arising out of that loss of use. There's circumstances whereby maybe it's a specialized suite, those types of things. The conundrum, I think, is taking that sentence to say we're not going to scrutinize how many vehicles are in the lot and equating that with we therefore eliminate entirely the obligation to prove an actual loss. Again, this is loss of use is a specialized damage, and regardless of what you put in your contract, don't you need to still prove an actual economic impact to your business?
What would the measure be then? I mean, that's the problem is, if I were going to instruct a jury, what would I tell them to consider?
To consider the specific circumstances in the case, in the evidence that's put in front of the jury. The concern here is that there's literally no economic impact and no evidence whatsoever of an economic impact. You might instruct the jury that they are charged with making that finding, that you must determine that there is, as a threshold issue, an actual economic impact or an economic loss to this business.
I hate to be impatient, but where do you land on this?
Well,
your actual loss theory. What is it? How much?
I'm sorry?
How much?
Is the actual loss?
Right.
Based on the testimony of the owner, there is no loss. And she testified to that very specific question. It's Exhibit O in the motion for summary judgment. And it's because she testified that she didn't know whether there was a loss because she never considered it that I think the trial court's motion for summary judgment is appropriate. The other thing that comes into play is we have the district court interpreting the contract to say, regardless of fleet utilization, therefore requires the rental car company to demonstrate that it would have rented this particular unit and removed from them the ability to do a fleet analysis. That's one interpretation. Second interpretation is what the Court of Appeals did. And in a struggle to make this phrase mean something, it came up with these loss prerequisites. By having two courts interpret the same contract language the same in different ways creates an ambiguity. And there's where I think the law favors the consumer in this situation. The consumer does not have the sophistication that National Car Rental has. If we look at, again, Exhibit O, Angela Horn's deposition, the document reference number is 189-11701. At pages 34 and 36, she provides a very detailed testimony as to the fact that this contract is dictated to her as a franchisee by the parent company. She testified that her employees are not authorized to make any alterations to the contract, and she testified that the consumer certainly is not authorized to make any changes. By having two different interpretations of the same contract language, we have an ambiguity, and I do believe the ambiguity should favor the consumer in this situation.
I'm not at all sure that two courts disagreeing establishes an ambiguity, but nonetheless, assuming that we nonetheless think it's ambiguous, to go back to Justice Hobbs' question, where does that take you? What is the meaning of this construed in your favor?
Well, I think the meaning of it, construed in our favor, follows the district court's rationale to say, we don't know why, we didn't draft the contract, we are not National Car Rental. These are national contracts. That verbiage may be in there because some other state requires that verbiage. And for them to do, it's easier to do, we see this in the insurance context a lot, it's easier to issue a policy and adjust it with some amendments so that you're trying to comply with all 50 states' regulations. We don't know why that language is.
You're going back to the takes an arrow out of the quiver?
Correct.
So your meaning is, but see, that's really the effect, isn't it? I mean, when you say that the meaning of this language is they can't use that evidence, there's nothing in there that talks about what evidence they may or may not use. It merely says that fleet utilization doesn't matter. So there's some jump to me that you're making in terms of your notion that the meaning of it is that they've agreed not to put certain evidence in.
I agree with you, Justice Martinez, that there is a jump that's going on, but I submit that...
Well, walk me through it instead of making the jump. If that's the effect of your meaning, so be it. But what is your meaning?
My meaning is, regardless of how they prove their loss, they still need to prove a loss. They still need to demonstrate an actual...
But you agree that it means that fleet utilization doesn't matter. Whether they've used it all or they haven't used it all, it doesn't make any difference at all. But it, and you have agreed to pay their loss, but they still have to establish a loss somehow.
The short answer is yes. The what I don't agree with is that that's the interpretation. My interpretation would follow the district court's interpretation, and that is that by saying we're not going to regard, we're not going to pay any attention to the use of the fleet, we are therefore going to limit it to this particular unit. You, plaintiff, are going to have to demonstrate that there was a demand or a need for this particular unit, if that's what you're going to do.
But why does it go to that particular unit since that unit is part of the fleet? So, see, that's what I'm kind of hung up on, is how can you ever even talk about any car?
And that raises the question, what is the meaning of fleet? Is the fleet only the SUVs in that subset? Is it only the compacts? This was a Hyundai... forget the but it was a small subcompact. Within each, and again, Angela Horn's deposition in the pages I cited, has detailed discussions of the various types of vehicles by which they do categories. And so fleet is even a subject of debate. Do they mean only the subcompacts? Do they mean only the economy class? Do they mean only a type of vehicle that's going to fit within this rental rate that would apply to the particular rental contract that Ms. Koenig signed? And so I think fleet is trouble. In going back to Justice Martinez's question, this court does not have to read the regardless of fleet utilization in the same manner that I am reading it or in the same manner the district court is reading it. The fact remains there are other ways of establishing an economic loss, and those other ways are not established or not addressed in this brief verbiage.
Well, let's just assume that the fleet is all of their cars, and if you can't talk about how they use all of their cars, how could you ever prove any damages for not using this one?
Because historic income is going to illustrate that. If we're not going to, if the concern is not allowing the jury to hear that during the 7 days that this car was going to be repaired, there were 100 other cars just sitting in the lot idle, they're going to lose that argument every time. The jury will always say, you got to be kidding me. And so I think that's what they're attempting to do, is they're trying to avoid that. If they're trying to avoid that, they should define it that way. I agree that these damages could be difficult to define, but that's why liquidated damages clauses exist. And National had an opportunity to put a liquidated damages clause into their contract, and it chose not to. Instead, it has this sort of vague reference to regardless of fleet utilization.
I don't know if this is the right question or not, but are you ruling out entirely loss of opportunity for the use of your property?
I apologize.
Loss of opportunity for the use of your property.
Am I ruling that out?
Yeah. I mean, is that...
No, I'm not. And here's why. Again, it goes back to the particular circumstances of this particular case. the respondent in their brief cites various uses that a rental car might make of their vehicle. They can rent a vehicle for promotional purposes. They can park the vehicle out at a golf tournament. They can hold vehicles back for dignitaries to use when they're in town. All of those are uses, and all of those are particular circumstances that a party could introduce evidence to the jury to demonstrate this actual economic impact. Here, however, the owner of the rental car company's testimony was those circumstances didn't exist for her. In the respondent's brief, they cite to a series of questions that respondent's counsel asked. And if you look at those questions, each of those questions asked the owner what she would want. Would you want an extra car in your lot? Would you want a different color of car in your lot? Yes, she would want those things. But when you ask her the specific question of her use of these vehicles, she testified that the only use for this particular car rental agency is the is renting it for profit. And by speaking to fleet utilization and using fleet broadly, the National Car Rental is not speaking to the unit. Meaning, it'd be one thing to write the contract to say, we're going to collect loss of use damages. It's going to be a presumed loss regardless of economic circumstances. We're not going to allow you to scrutinize the use of this unit. All that could have been incorporated in the contract and was not. It is a slippery slope to say that regardless of fleet utilization, suddenly wipes out every economic theory that exists and every piece of evidence that might be presented to demonstrate an actual loss.
Counsel, if I might interrupt you. I would like to take a couple of steps backwards, I guess, and have you address your opponent's concern that when talking about loss of use in other contexts, in the individual context or even a company context where the vehicle being used is a company vehicle to conduct the company's business, proof of loss of use is not required. It's simply presumed, and those damages then are assessed or calculated by, you know, reasonable rental replacement costs. I guess I'm struggling to understand what your response is to that argument that this context is somehow different and we're suddenly shoved into net profits when, in fact, the damages being claimed are still loss of use. So why are we suddenly in a profit world that necessarily requires proof of those damages, whereas they're presumed in the other context?
Because this particular contract deals with the sale of use as a product.
There's contract language that reflects that, or are you just saying that this is just a commercial context?
This is a commercial context, okay. And the only, again, we go back to the owner's testimony that the only use of the vehicle, the only reason for her owning the vehicle is to rent it for profit. And that moves it, I believe, into the economic arena. And if we look at all the personal use vehicle cases that are out there, Francis being sort of, to me, the most specifically on point with a discussion. In each of those cases, there is evidence of a need for the vehicle in question. And here again, I think the respondent's position would be different if they had evidence of a need that they could point to. I would like to read a quote from the Francis versus Stephen Johnson Pontiac case. The court wrote, "Here, in addition to proof of the need for substitute transportation, evidence was presented as to the cost of renting a car comparable to the damaged vehicle. Here she has proved her need for replacement during that period. Under these facts, she was entitled to reasonable rental value." In the Francis case, she was able to present evidence of having to make other arrangements, having to take the bus, having to ask friends for help. Those are personal damages, personal to the individual, similar to frustration. Frustration is a type of damage that a personal plaintiff might be able to recover, but in the commercial context, all of the case law, I think, is pretty clearly on point. Not on point, but clearly in its communication that commercial contexts are different. That if the vehicle exists If the purpose of the business is to simply sell the use of that vehicle for a short period of time, then lost net profits should be the standard.
So then in essence, the damages here are not loss of use, they're lost profits, really.
Correct. In this particular case, because again, there's no evidence of an alternate use for this particular car rental agency.
So they're not entitled to loss of use. In other words, they're only entitled to lost profits.
Correct.
Is your position?
In our position.
Okay.
Given the circumstances of this case. I have 37 seconds I'm going to reserve. Thank you.
Okay.
May it please the court, Steve Mashaki arguing for PureCo Fleet Services. And Justice Hodgson, you're right, the parties do agree. It's probably a welcome thing for all of you on one of the two issues. Neither party likes the lost prerequisites. What we're really talking about here is the different reasons why the parties don't like the lost prerequisites. According to my opponent and the trial court's interpretation of the contract, this contract means that we would have had to show that all other cars, all 999 or 99 cars in the fleet, were already in use, such that this particular car would have been rented to a customer. And therefore, naturally, they're arguing that the lost prerequisites require too little proof. Our position is diametrically opposed, that this contract language makes fleet utilization irrelevant. You don't look to whether or how the rest of the fleet was being used. And so you don't determine whether this particular car was needed for rental. The whole purpose of that language is to obviate the need to consider the utilization of the rest of the fleet.
Is the fleet all of the cars?
The fleet is all of the cars.
So if you can't look at all to any of the cars, what do you propose a measure of damage be?
We propose a measure of damage that is in the contract, which is loss of use. And we determine that loss of use regardless of utilization of the fleet.
And while but isn't that almost just a presumptive kind of measure of damage? We don't get to use this car. We don't even get the opportunity to rent this car because it's being fixed, and therefore you have to pay for it.
That's exactly right.
And isn't that, in essence, just a penalty as opposed to a measure of damage?
It is not just a penalty, Your Honor, because we lose a tangible right. We lose the right to use that car in any way we deem fit, and in all of the ways in which, in fact, this particular national franchisee used the car. And I'd like to take a little foray into the facts, because contracts do
so. So it would really work out almost better for the franchisee, for the national car people, if the car gets damaged, because that way at least they're guaranteed of the 6 or 7 days rent that it takes to repair the car.
Well,
isn't in essence that
in a particular case that might be true.
Yeah.
And
if that's in fact true, then why isn't that indeed just a penalty?
It's not just a penalty, because there are rights in the use of personal property that are being taken away from the owner of the property, and that is true in a personal property case, in a commercial case, or when property is rented out for use. You know, there's an example of this I'll give you is the KLM case. I mean, in that case, it involved the loss of a large plane because of an engine fire. So it was a product liability suit. And the court said, well, due to the Arab oil embargo, if they would have flown this plane, they would have lost money. In fact, not only it would have been much, much better for them, because they would have lost money due to the much higher costs of fuel. Yet the court said they're entitled to loss of use nevertheless. They have lost. It is not out-of-pocket costs you're compensating. It is the right to use that is compensable. And so it's perfectly consistent. This contract, in other words, is perfectly consistent with the theory and the common law as it is developed. Now, I'd like to address...
Could I just follow up 1 second on that? And it's kind of been something that's bothered me throughout. The link that I'm missing is you keep saying, and therefore we're allowed to recover for loss of use, but that's not measured by whether we could have rented the car. The presumption there is, therefore, the loss of use is the amount we charge to rent it, I guess. That's what you're saying your loss is measured on, the rental fee. But why is that the case, and is there anything in this contract that suggests that's the case?
Well, that sort of brings us into the case law, I guess. It is the traditional measure of loss of use in this court's cases, in the Court of Appeals cases, and in other cases around the country. It's essentially the default measure of use. You look at, if for a personal use, you sometimes look at what's the rental cost of a substitute. But what you're doing is saying, we've lost the use of this, so how much would it cost to compensate us and give us back the use of it? And the traditional loss is either lease out or
lease. And your contract language, though, seems to say, but we're not going to determine that based on whether we, on the amount we could have rented it for on any given day. So we've eliminated that. And so the presumption from that seems to be, so we don't have to prove anything. Our loss will be measured by the amount we're charging you for it.
Well, I don't think the contract says we're excluding that measure in any way. It's saying loss of use regardless of fleet utilization, and the fight here is over what does loss of use mean.
And what does fleet utilization mean?
That's right. And I think that what you need to do here is you need to interpret this contract in context. Any contract needs to be interpreted in context. Now, counsel was talking about the deposition of Angela Horn, and he's referring to one question and answer in her deposition and excluding the rest of it. And what I'll point you to, unfortunately, this case came up in kind of a netherworld between consecutively numbered hard copy records and consecutively numbered CDs. So the best I can do is refer you to the pleading, which is our response to the motion for summary judgment on damages. Exhibits 2 and 3. Exhibit 2 is a deposition of Angela Horn. Exhibit 3 is a deposition of Shane Ashton, who is a Pureco vice president. And here's what Ms. Horn says in her deposition. This is in the neighborhood of pages 136 to 39. She says that National keeps more cars in its fleet than needed for rentals. And she also says that there's a variety of purposes for its cars. One of them is fleet diversity. You want to have a variety of sizes, models, colors for people to choose from. One of them is substitutions and upgrades. She said that in a slow period, they have maybe 2 to 5 cars in the shop. In a heavy period where they're running out a lot, they might have 5 to 10 cars in the shop. So they need it for substitutions. They need it for upgrades. They use it for display and advertising, and they use it for manager benefits. And Mr. Ashton corroborated that really all rental car companies have all of these same purposes. So National uses its cars every day. It might not use a car or need a car to actually rent it out, but it needs it in its fleet for all those purposes. Now, National doesn't keep individual utilization records. It keeps fleet utilization records. In other words, National keeps records that say, here's how many intermediate cars, like a Sonata, were rented in a particular month, because every 6 months they get rid of their cars and they get new ones. They want to know how many intermediate cars to get versus SUVs. So they replace that stock. Now, the import of this is, and this gets back to, I think, some questions that Justice Rice was asking. It would be virtually impossible for National to ever prove that this particular car would have been rented on any particular days, because that's not the way the business is run. It's just not run that way. They keep way more cars than they need. You never want to have a customer walk in to a rental car.
Nishaki, I understand your argument that there is a loss of use because the car has some value to National, even if it's not rented out, and in terms of how you made that, in terms of how it completes feet and offers things to customers, et cetera, et cetera. I guess you said that you're going to the default measure of loss in getting to that sort of approach to the law, that there is a loss of use. Well, my question is, if this contract did not have the parenthetical, so it was just an agreement to pay loss of use, wouldn't that, by virtue of your logic, lead you down the same trail?
I think it probably would. That's right.
So the parenthetical actually has no meaning then in your argument.
It does have meaning, and I'm just getting to that right now. The intent of this language, loss of use regardless of fleet utilization, is that it takes fleet utilization out of consideration. So even if other cars are available to rent, we still get compensated because due to Ms. Koenig's conduct, we were unable to use that car for any purpose.
Yes, but you would make that same argument if you did not have the parenthetical regardless of fleet utilization, right? You would be still here saying the measure of loss here is that the car has value to us even if the fleet is not utilized.
I would be making that argument, or at least I'd be trying to make it. I would have to be dealing, though, for example, with the Brooklyn Terminal line of cases that say, well, if you've got a fleet of vehicles and you're able to compensate, and in that case, it's a little different than ours. I think they had 3 tugboats, and they were able to compensate with their remaining 2, and they had a fixed amount of cargo they brought every day. So it wasn't a situation like this where we don't know how many customers are coming in. But there is that line of cases.
Well, it seems like that line of cases is suggesting that concept of mitigation of damage. Basically, if you can make do with 2, we're not going to let you recover for the 3. And that's what you're concerned about. And it seems to me like that's, I don't know, but at least perhaps that's why you put that in your language. So you would take away this whole concept of mitigation of damages. Couldn't we bring a couple up from Cortez to be in Durango or wherever, whatever? I suspect that that's the kind of evidence that you're trying to get out of your cases, right?
I think that's right. I think that the Court of Appeals said, in fact, that the fleet utilization language was an attempt
to
address that line of cases.
Sure. And that's all very sensible, and that makes some sense. The problem is that there's nothing, from my perspective, that the plaintiff can do to prove anything which would limit or even contest the damages that you say are basically presumed at this point. If you wreck the car, you pay as if you were renting the car while it was getting fixed. That's essentially your measure of damage, isn't it? What can a plaintiff do to contest that?
The plaintiff can ensure, and I think this gets back to, we had some talk about special versus general damages and what that means, and Hunter v. Quaintance. But I think what that means is that, Hunter v. Quaintance says loss of use is special damages, but here's what it says that means. You have to plead loss of use, and you have to show that repairs were made with reasonable promptness. And that's where the mitigation comes in. We need to show, and if we don't, I think that they will prevail on their mitigation of damages.
So it all gets down to a question of how fast the body shop can work? Because, if I remember the briefs here, there was minor damage. She hit a deer or something like that?
Yeah, she hit a deer. There was damage to the driver's side headlight, the hood, and the side.
So we're going to have expert testimony on how quickly that should have been repaired?
Well, no, I think that where we...
Now, where's the logical extension of that argument?
So where we go is this. We have to make... The mitigation for PureCo/National is you've got to promptly get a hold of the repair shop, fill out your damage report, promptly get it over to the shop, promptly pay and pick it up when it's ready. So you need to prove that the amount of time for repair was, in fact, reasonable. Here we had actually, due to the backup in or the backlog that local repair shops had, there was actually 27 days when this car was out of service. But we nevertheless charged the 6.75 days that was reflected on the original repair estimate that we got from the shop. But that's where mitigation comes in here, is to ensure that we're actually proving the measure of damages that Hunter v. Quaintance and all the cases in Colorado since then have said that we need to prove. So,
why don't you just say in your contracts, if you wreck the car, you're going to have to pay for the days that it's being repaired? It's as if you're still renting it.
I think the contract could say that, and I think that effectively.
Because that's in effect what you're doing. That's what you say your measure of damage is.
That's correct.
And you say that there's really nothing that a plaintiff can do to argue that measure of damage, except to say, well, the body shop should have worked a little bit faster.
Or that we didn't process the claim quickly enough, et cetera. That's right.
Let me ask you something else. The assuming, accepting the notion that there's a loss of use for many of the reasons that you've indicated, it seems to me there's still a leap to say that that's at X amount per day. So why is it that the loss of use is the rental value that National sets? I mean, how do you have to prove that? And I guess I would sort of add to that that in my very limited experience, I presume that that's a very volatile market, very competitive, that the rental charge changes a lot. You know, you might charge more to me than to Justice Rice because she came in through a different portal or has a different discount code or rented on a different day or for a different time period. So how do you get to whatever it is, $28 a day?
Well, I think what you just described actually makes the measure reasonable. In other words, and incidentally, there's no dispute here that $33.89 was a reasonable daily rental. The fact that there is a rental market for this, and it is a very efficient and competitive market, I think indicates that that is a rate that is reasonable. So we need the two things we need to prove up under Hunter v. Quaintance and Airborne, much more recent, et cetera, is reasonable rental value and reasonable period of repair time. And we did both of those things here, and they're not contested. There's never been any dispute here by the other side that $33.89 was not a reasonable rate.
Could I just follow up on that? Absolutely. On that one point, because I think these are all related to what we've been asking. But it seems that what you're saying is the car has value for reasons other than being rented out that day. It helps your fleet in various ways. But I guess the question and the leap that we're looking for, at least that I'm looking for, is, but why is its loss to the institution the same as its rental value for that day? I can understand if what we're saying is we could have rented it out that day, then that's the amount.
Right.
But if we've lost its use for some other purpose, why is that other purpose equivalent to the rental value of it?
Because that's what we would need to pay to replace that use. I mean, whether the car is going to be, you know, sitting there for, you know, in our lot.
Well, I took it what you were saying about sitting there in a lot. It has a lot of almost intangible values. It provides greater choices. It might help us rent another car because it's there. I don't know what they are, but if it's not, I mean, if it is a question of its value to be rented that day, then it seems that it may be necessary to show some likelihood that you could rent it. But if it's for a different purpose, then how do we measure the value of that other purpose?
Well, again, the traditional measure in case law, I think this is where we get into the case law, whether it's a tort case or a contract case, personal use, commercial use, has always been rental value. And frankly, the reason it has been that way is because it's easy. It is when you're compensating for loss of use, the courts have said, this is in Kuwait Airlines, for example, it's not designed for out-of-pocket compensation, but to provide approximate compensation for lost rights. And so, you know, the car represents a bundle of rights, and you have all these things you can do for it. And it makes things certain, and it makes things uniform. And that's the rationale for using loss of use. You're giving this approximate compensation for lost rights rather than compensating for a particular lost use, like running the car out. So that's the response that I have. In terms of, I'd like to move to proof now of the amount of damages. The court here said it was lost net profits. I think I've address that in saying essentially that's not a measure we could prove, and this contract is designed to prove a different measure or to allow for a different measure of damages. Here the court said, well, you know, you're still going to, you know, the gross lease out value has to be netted back, because you have to look at, I suppose, you know, overhead and depreciation and such. And so I want to address that issue particularly. First of all, you know, these deductions are not part, certainly, of Colorado law in any of the Colorado cases we've cited, whether in personal use or commercial use. Again, the reasonable rental value is an approximation of damages for these lost rights. Furthermore, though, I mean, Ms. Koenig's, the costs that really the court is looking at are largely sunk costs. And this is referenced in the McCormick treatise. Ms. Koenig, for example, in her briefing, the only cost she says we should have deducted from the gross rental value were cleaning and counter staff. Well, we don't fire or reduce the hours of cleaning and counter staff because one car is in the shop. Quite the contrary, the evidence is in the record that it requires more work, not less work, when a car is in the shop. We need to fill out a report, we need to call the repair shop, we need to get two estimates, or here State Farm required us to get a third estimate. We need to bring the car to the shop, we need to pick it up and pay for it, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't, you know, these are sunk costs. We don't pay less rent at the airport. We don't pay less utilities. So those are things that don't make a lot of sense in terms of deductions, even if we weren't using this measure of the rough approximation. Depreciation, I guess I would have the same arguments about. First of all, it ignores the underlying rationale of what you're actually compensating for, given this rough approximation of what the lost use is. Furthermore, it assumes only rough use. It assumes, I guess back to your question somewhat, it assumes that the only use for this car was to rent it out. And in fact, there were multiple uses. And furthermore, it seems to me, favor individual use over business use. Because, in fact, in cases like Francis and in numerous of the other cases we've cited, you don't deduct depreciation. In fact, I'm sure when State Farm provides a loaner car to someone when their own car is hurt, they don't go out and say, well, we're going to deduct the depreciation that would have occurred with respect to your car, but for this accident. Let me turn very briefly to the lost prerequisites. The court said that the last prerequisites were designed to prove a lost opportunity to earn profits, and that hence that we had to show that at least one car in our fleet, you know, was going to be needed during the rental period. Two things about this. Number one, it's contrary to the contract language, which obviates fleet utilization. And secondly, it just makes no sense if the goal is to provide this approximate compensation for lost right to use.
Don't you have to establish that somehow you would have used at that particular time? I mean, I understand you want to tie it to the lost profits, but in any loss of use claim, don't you have to establish that there would have been some use?
Well, I think that the short answer to your question, first of all, is no. I mean, there's really, if you look at the case law, you don't have to establish what your specific use of the vehicle.
Not specific, but I don't care. You whatever.
Some use, sure. But again, here, you know.
Well, let's just say that the testimony of the owner established that they were going to close their business for 3 weeks because they were going on vacation. Would you still get reasonable rental value for every day?
Well, there's law to the effect that the answer is yes. In other words, you know, just the comfort of knowing my car is sitting there is good enough for me.
But isn't that, I mean, you're laughing at that. I mean, isn't that kind of silly?
Because it is silly, and I'm also laughing because it really doesn't relate to this case at all. We had plenty of uses for this car, and you know,
but isn't that the two prerequisites? Isn't it? Aren't they trying to get at you would have been open?
And we would have.
Okay. But I mean, that's why I'm trying to figure out why you're challenging the prerequisites.
we're challenging that.
Is it just merely theoretical because it violates the fleet utilization interpretation?
Certainly in terms of the rear open part, it's not going to be difficult for PureCo to prove that it was open. It's an airport rental agency. It's open 365 days a year. And that somebody would have wanted to rent one car on these days. But again, particularly with respect to the second requirement, it directly butts up against the lack of the irrelevance of fleet utilization. It's asking us to show that someone wanted to use one of these cars to drive as opposed to our other uses for these cars, including substitution, display, employee perks, manager perks, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We had a use for these cars every day, is my point. All of these cars had a use every day for one or more of these purposes.
But I guess, so are you conceding that you would have to show at least that you were open? Because you couldn't use the cars unless you were open.
I suppose.
And that's, well, I guess you were, I mean, I think you would say that you'd be parking your cars at a golf tournament the day that you were closed, kind of shows the absurdity of your position, and to my mind at least, that if you have a car but we're not willing to use it, but we managers drive it out to a golf tournament, then we still have a lost profit, and we park them there.
But
the big sign saying National provided these cars.
You would have.
To me, just the strangest measure of damage, because it's not really a measure of damage. It's just, here are damages, and you prove that we're not entitled to them, is really what you guys are saying. It seems to me, it's the measure of damages is, here's what we think we're going to get, and you show us plaintiff how we're wrong and how we haven't calculated this. But there's not kind of a proof that this is what you've actually lost. It's like working against this number X 6 days at $30. You show us how what we ought to deduct from that, as opposed to the normal sort of measure of damages is here's what we've lost to get to X. It's the cart before the horse. It's upside down.
This is the way loss of use damage has been.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've tried some loss of use cases, and there certainly was some evidence which would show the loss of use or the loss of profit or whatever it was, but it wasn't this sort of assumption of damage and then take pot shots at it to see if you can lower it.
And I would simply disagree, though, that you're just assuming. In other words, we have this right. We've got this right to use this car in whatever way we want. We have demonstrated through the testimony that, in fact, these cars are used in a variety of ways, including just to hold in place in case we need to replace it. I mean, even in the Brooklyn Terminal case, the court said, if you've got something that you hold as a substitute ready to go in case something goes down, you're not deprived of your loss of use measure, of your reasonable rental value measure. So I would disagree that this is simply an assumed loss. It is a real loss, a tangible loss of real property rights, and it was caused by Ms. Koenig hitting the deer. If there are no more questions, I'd like to conclude with this. The trial court here said essentially because we couldn't prove that we would have rented this car, summary judgment was appropriate against us. We've shown that there's no need for such proof, that we did prove both the rental value and the reasonable period of time, and accordingly, our position is that we were entitled to summary judgment. Those facts are not disputed. In any event, as many courts, including the Kuwait Airlines Court, has said, the loss of use during repair can't be worthless. It has to be worth something. And so, with respect to that fact, the court should at least remand so that we can prove up our damages under whatever standard the court adopts. Thank you very much.
Powers, rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice. And I will be very brief. I think the questions from the panel illustrate the conundrum or the problem that arises if we adopt the respondent's position that regardless of fleet utilization somehow equates to a total abandonment of any evidence of
some loss, some tangible, measurable, identifiable loss arising out of the use. Again, if we look at all, even the personal use, the vehicles or the cases dealing with personal vehicles, all of them require some evidence from the plaintiff of a loss arising.
What do you think our order ought to say? Is it a remand or isn't it?
I would ask the court to reinstitute the motion for summary judgment on, or the order granting summary judgment on this particular issue of did a loss arise under these particular circumstances because of the lack of evidence of a loss and because of the respondent's position that their position with the trial court is we don't have to show you anything, Judge. You get to presume it. And it's the rental rate, and we don't have to prove anything beyond that. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank both lawyers for their arguments. The case will be submitted on the briefs.